Please be advised this podcast contains descriptions of graphic violence and is not appropriate for children.
At 10:30, I let the children out for recess, and only minutes later they came running back inside saying, Mr. Hunter, there's a man outside with a gun, and he was highly agitated. I actually didn't realise it was as serious as it was. He had a strong agenda, and that was the way it unfolded.
This week marks the 42nd anniversary of the terrifying and random kidnapping of a country school teacher and his class of 9 children from a tiny school in country Victoria. At just 20 years old and 9 days into his first teaching job out of university, Rob Hunter was that teacher.
This is Australian True Crime with Michelle Laurie and Emily Webb.
Rob's book, Day 9 at Warreen, is described by readers as captivating, authentic and deeply moving, which is probably unsurprising when you consider it's the story of an almost 24-hour kidnapping ordeal that kept expanding in its scope and depravity. The story is told by a man who was not only fearing for his own life during every bizarre second, but also for the lives of the 9 children placed by their trusting parents into his care. Let's begin by finding out from Rob Hunter who he was just before this life-changing event that took place on February 14, 1977.
I was a very green would-be teacher, just finished 3 very good intensive years of teacher training, a very normal young fella, loved sport and had lots of good friends and had come from a very supportive family, excited to be getting into the teaching game, having been given an appointment for this one teacher school down in South Gippsland, which I was really excited about. I found out that I had 9 children.
Had you always wanted to be a teacher?
Yeah. So I actually applied for rural schools in the Leongatha area and I got one.
Got one. So you swan into town, the new teacher.
And from the photos, you look tall, you're good looking, you got your 1970s beard.
Good looking, you reckon, yeah. Emily?
I think so. I would say that you were young, you would have been quite a catch down around.
And were the families nice, like the mums making you cakes and that and welcoming you to the community?
Very, very welcoming. Nice. We had a barbecue, welcome teacher barbecue, get to know your parents barbecue, the Wednesday or Thursday night just before this event. This event happened on day 9.
Of your teaching
of my
career.
Teaching career, of my time with these students.
Wow.
Yeah. Arrived at school as normal at about 8:15. Let the children in for school at about 9:15, which was the normal routine. Had the patriotic ceremony, which was normal again.
What's that?
Patriotic ceremony. No. God save the Queen. Mm. I love God and my country. I shall honour the flag and serve the Queen, chiefly obey my parents, teachers and the law. That's the oath of allegiance.
It's in the 80s when I went to school.
It ceased in the 80s. It was probably only just hanging on in 1977. Mm-hmm. I was a bit of a traditionalist. I liked it. The children came in, had a normal morning of writing, maths. At 10:30, I let the children out for recess. And only minutes later they came running back inside saying, Mr. Hunter, there's a man outside with a gun. I didn't think too much of it. I wandered to the door, not wanting to overreact to their alarmist attitudes. And I thought it would just be someone wanting to shoot a rabbit or something like that. But no, I was dramatically, I guess, confronted with this balaclava hooded man pointing a gun directly at my chest saying, get back inside or I'll effing shoot you. He was puffing and panting and perspiring profusely and he was highly agitated. Very scary sight. I did exactly what he told me for those first minutes at least.
My kids now at their primary school have got this lockdown procedure that they rehearse a couple of times a year and all that. Was there anything of that nature in your training at Teachers Training College in the 70s?
Not in the least. Yeah. This was the furthest thing from my mind. It was total surprise. I actually didn't realise it was as serious as it was. I thought this guy was just a bit of a crank and I'd be able to get around him after a little bit of nice talk and that I'd be able to write a check out or hand over some cash or speak nicely to him or, you know, and he would leave and reason would prevail. But no, he had a strong agenda and that was the way it unfolded.
Okay, what was it? So he's forced you back into the room, I guess, you and all the kids. What unfolded?
So we were initially all chained up with a 10-metre long dog chain with padlocks. Both my wrists were chained. The children's just one wrist was chained to the long dog chain. And so we're all chained together, 10 of us in a row. He secures us to a panel and goes and gets his vehicle, which is parked down the side road. All the time I'm thinking, what can I do to short-circuit this? Yeah, I offered to write out a check. I offered, you know, what would you like? I can write out a big check. I'm in charge of the books. Mm. No, mate, that's not the sort of money that I want. So, yeah, I kept on thinking, what can I do? Can we get out of here somewhere? One of the children run off. One of the children was sitting near the door. I signaled to them to make a run for it when he wasn't looking at one stage. They didn't understand what I wanted, thankfully, because that could have been disastrous. At one stage, the gun was within reach. I considered grabbing the gun. He was a strong man. I think I automatically realised that I couldn't overpower him physically before I got chained up. So I continued to do what I was asked to do. The phone was in the office, and that was on my mind. I was hoping that I might have been able to get to the phone or get one of the students to get to the phone. But before he left the premises, he ripped the speaker out of the earpiece of the phone and so that we weren't able to make a phone call.
So what was he after? I mean, you're offering him money? He's ripped the earpiece out of the phone. So, you know, that says to me that he didn't even want more money or he didn't want you to be able to phone somebody and demand anything else. What did he want?
A massive, unreasonable amount of demands. $5 million worth of used US currency, a lot of drugs, a lot of arms, and perhaps the most ridiculous demand was the release of 17 prisoners of friends that were in Pentridge Prison at the time.
You list these in your book, Rob, the actual script of what your kidnapper, who we'll talk about who he was, and he'd had a bit of form, hadn't he, before this happened. But in Rob's book that he's written, Day 9 at Warreen, there's actually the demands and the script that was basically written out by this man.
In impeccable, perfect handwriting.
Wait for this, listeners. $7 million, US dollars. So back in 1977, that would make you a billionaire basically, wouldn't it, these days? 100 kilograms of pure Latin American cocaine and 100 kilos of pure heroin, as well as releasing the 17 prisoners. Actually, we've heard a few of these names, Michelle. We've previously interviewed a former Pentridge prison guard. So we've got Peter Walker, Barry Quinn, who we've heard about, Peter Lawless, I think, and Robert Barron. Remember he spoke about Bobby Barron, who murdered the two Salvation Army people. So the pretty serious people on this list.
Yeah. So those demands were ridiculous or outlandish.
Yes.
Impossible to
be met.
Mm. Well, I talk about this a little bit in the book, not a great deal, but it was grandiose thinking, really, and it was essentially a media spectacle. I think the kidnapper wanted to become the most famous criminal of all time.
Reading or hearing that list, it sounds to me like mental illness. Was there mental illness involved or was it actually meant to be outlandish to get in the paper?
Yeah, I don't think there was mental illness. I think he was very sound mind.
Oh, okay. So it was meant to be outlandish to get attention.
I think so.
So what were you meant to do with it all? So you're chained up with the children and then what happens? He leads you out?
So eventually we get put into this utility. The children then separated from me because the chains are taken off my wrists and I'm blindfolded, gagged, hands tied behind my back and forced into the front of the utility. on the floor of the utility with my head on the seat out of the way so I can't be seen. The children in the back still all chained up, and we drive. And we drove for about 2.5 hours.
Oh, my goodness, that's a long time under these circumstances. Wow.
Until we came to an abrupt halt. But during those 2.5 hours, we stopped at Merbu North and posted this ransom letter.
Posted it? Snail mail?
Posted it in a post box. It had been well written prior.
And you said it was in meticulous, neat, very clear handwriting.
Is he chatting to you during the drive when you're on the floor?
I'm gagged, so I can't speak initially. The first words that are spoken to me are that I particularly remember when I'm on the floor is, good on you, mate. If I was in this position, I'd be doing what you're doing. I'd be compliant too. And I thought, oh, okay, is that what I am? Compliant? I think that was the word that was used. Okay, yep, I'm doing what I'm told. Yeah, so then later on there was more questions asked which required an answer, and the gag came off my mouth, though I was able to give some semblance of answers. I wasn't really in the mood for talking. One of the questions was asked was, do you think I'll get a good ransom for you? Do you think I'll get $40,000?
Is there much noise coming out of the children in the back of the car?
Yes, a lot. They were vomiting and banging on the panels, stop, we want a drink, but there was no response. We continued on our way.
Oh, the poor little buggers.
I feel so stressed listening to this, so I can't actually even imagine. I'm just thinking of what your brain would have been doing, just, you know, in hyperdrive and just your, because as a teacher it's in loco parentis. You are the parent when you're a teacher. And you're just looking after them.
I'm so scared for them all these years later being noisy, because I'm thinking, shush, he could kill you. Don't annoy this guy. You can't bang on the glass. You can't be saying you want a drink, you know?
Kids Helplessness do. Is the best word that comes to my mind. So about 2.5 hours along the journey, going around obvious windy dirt roads with the occasional vehicle passing us, I heard the odd truck, probably 2 or 3 trucks that we'd passed, but we eventually collided with one. And we very nearly all got killed. Just on the corner where we nearly go over the edge of the road, there's a strong wooden 4 or 5 inch square post, which is right, ends up next to my door. That post was the only thing that stopped us from going over the edge. Part of our vehicle was hanging over the edge. Our back wheel was suspended in midair. 2 truck drivers in that truck. The driver of that truck becomes the hero later on. He continues to be a hero. I like the way we've been able to talk about him in the book. He's described as a hero, and he's nothing but a hero. He's a gutsy, smart, unassuming, wonderful man who we love deeply.
What's his name? Can't say. Oh.
His name's Robin Smith.
Yeah. The and most, you get so emotional
the
just
most
thinking about
ordinary him. Bloke you would ever come across. But he risked his life. Not then. He waited his time very smartly and appropriately the next morning.
Wow.
This is just feeling.
All these years later.
Yeah.
Wow. We'll get to Robert. We'll get to the next morning. But take us back first to the roadside when you first encountered Robin Smith.
So I'm still blindfolded. I've got no idea what's happened. I've hit my head against the dash, and the kids are crying in the back. He can't get the kids out of the vehicle because it's hanging over the edge of the road. The back of the vehicle's inaccessible. 2 truck drivers, so they're a problem for the kidnapper. They get forced to lie down on the road. The chains eventually taken off the children after he gets the children out of the side of the vehicle through a window that he smashes, with the glass going everywhere all over the children. Children climb out through the window, chains taken off the children, put onto the two truck drivers. Eventually I'm out and I'm chained to the two truck drivers as well. We wait for probably half an hour and another truck comes along with two more truck drivers. When I say truck drivers, there's a truck driver with a passenger. And they're then lying on the road, so there's five men. I'm now thinking, beauty, I'm a bit safer. I'm not going to get a bullet through my head necessarily. I think I'm a bit safer now. Another hour goes by. Nothing happens. We're thinking, what on earth is how can this, why doesn't he just give up and go home? What vehicle is going to come along that's going to allow a good outcome here? It seemed like he was desperate and he would take the children and maybe leave us men behind, have the children to himself. I didn't want to be separated from the children.
What a horrible thought.
The ideal vehicle comes along, probably the only vehicle you could imagine. Needed to be a minibus, basically, didn't it? It was a camper van with two angels in it, not literal angels, but two beautiful women, 48-year-old women about, who were camping, and they loved the kids and looked after them.
So that's okay.
Right.
That's okay. I mean, I can't imagine the trauma.
Do you realise how many times I've told this story? I don't usually cry, but somehow or other you guys are making it happen.
Well, I mean, I can't
feel
imagine
like crying
the
and I didn't
Yeah, it's an incredibly traumatic event. So these women who came along, I mean, did they stop? Were they? How did they become part of the group?
So the road is totally blocked. It's a tiny little road. Grand Ridge Road, English's Corner, is the intersection of Budgery Road and the Grand Ridge Road. And we're about 150 metres further along east along the Grand Ridge Road. There's no way a vehicle could get past. So the two women come along and there's a roadblock. The kidnapper kidnaps them as well and commandeers their vehicle. The children then meet the two ladies and the two ladies straight away put their arms around them.
How many hostages do we have by this stage?
I think there's 16.
This guy is just unbelievable.
So altogether there's 17 people that get pushed into this camper van. The five of us blokes are chained still and we're chained into the van. And then we drive for another 2.5 hours to the camping spot that had been set up in far off southeast Gippsland, not too far from Yarram and Woodside, in a forest called the Mullanjung State Forest.
After the break, we'll find out about the kidnapper, his shocking previous crimes, and the flukish chain of events that led him to Rob's classroom that day. Coming up on Australian True Crime, Rob describes how the hero truck driver, Robin Smith, managed to escape and raise the alarm, leading to the terrifying conclusion of the kidnapping. But first, Rob tells us everything he came to know later about his kidnapper.
The kidnapper is Edwin John Eastwood, who had 5 years previously done the Faraday kidnapping. He'd escaped from jail mid-December prior to this February the 14th. So he'd been on the run for 2 months. Police had been having a big high-scale search for him but hadn't really been able to identify where he was. I think Eastwood's part of his agenda was to get revenge on the police and to show them that what had happened at Faraday wasn't just because Robert Boland had been, from Eastwood's point of view, inappropriately convicted. Robert Boland was Eastwood's associate in the Faraday kidnapping.
Now, the Faraday kidnapping, Rob, for the listeners, in your words, what had happened?
So in 1972, Eastwood and Boland allegedly kidnapped Mary Gibbs and her six girls from the school at Faraday near Bendigo. and Mary Gibbs was the hero in that event. She had heroically kicked out a panel while Eastwood and Boland were off organising a ransom. Mary Gibbs had kicked out a panel of the van that they were in and been able to run off with the children, and some rabbiters, hunters, they'd come across them and they'd taken them to safety.
So this is his second school kidnapping.
Yeah, very similar scenarios, quite a few similarities. One of the similarities was the phone, the earpiece of the phone being ripped out. A remote school, one teacher, small number of children.
So had he been staking out your school?
The fact that he got to my school was a mistake. That morning he'd gone to Allenby South State School and there were extra personnel there, so he decided not to kidnap them. He then decided to go to Halston, which was another school just nearby, but he took a wrong turn and ended up at my school, Warroon. So we just happened to be the lucky ones.
Just inches and seconds, isn't it? It's those things we hear about all the time in this podcast.
So if you can take us back to that night when the 16 hostages are now in the camper van and he's got you to his campsite that is prepared, what is waiting there? He didn't know there'd be 16 of you, by the way. He had planned one teacher and some children.
When we arrived at the camping spot, there was some supplies there hidden under a tarpaulin. And there was a large tree in a cleared area, relatively cleared area. It had obviously been camped in for a while. Us five men were chained around the tree. The women and the children were free to settle down in the grass. And some of the scant supplies were passed around. Milk, not much water, some ham and some chocolate.
How are the children holding up by this stage?
The children seem really fine at this point because these two beautiful women that have been looking after them. Out of those nine children, there's six girls and three boys. The three boys go into the camper van to sleep and the six girls lie down with the two women in a low area on the other side of the tree from me. I'm partly obscured from seeing where the children are by this large tree. Eastwood lies down in a deck chair, eventually goes off to sleep. Robin Smith is opposite him. Robin is quite strategically actually sort of moved around a little bit so he couldn't be seen.
This is the truck driver.
Yeah, Robin's the hero. He'd been able to get his hand out of the chain that evening. We'd all been given an opportunity to go to the toilet. Robin quite smartly had done a bit of a trick to make sure that the chain wasn't done up too tight. And he was able to force his hand through. I think he did a bit of damage to his thumb in actually doing this, but he was able to quietly get his hand out and waited and waited and waited until around about 5 a.m. and snuck off and ran to the nearest farmhouse. He would have been shot for sure. He wasn't sure that Eastwood was asleep at that point. He hoped that Eastwood was asleep, but he risked big time taking a bullet for us all. He knew the area really well. He remembered this farmhouse. He knew where we were.
Wow, he's the man to have there.
Yeah.
So he got there and raised the alarm.
He did, which was a little bit of a story in itself because the people who he arrived at didn't want to open the door because they were a little bit worried about this stranger that arriving at their house at 6 a.m. in the morning. But eventually they did open the door. Couldn't understand what he wanted because they didn't speak very good English. Precious minutes elapsed. Robin's hope was that he would have been able to get police back while everyone was asleep, but that didn't happen. So eventually, probably about 6:30, everyone wakes up, including Eastwood. The radio's going, we're listening to the news. A lot of talk about these missing children and possible kidnapping, and Eastwood's enjoying listening to that news bulletin, but eventually gets up and notices that Robin Smith is absent. He'd used the nickname Singlet for Robin. Robin had been wearing a blue singlet.
A trucky singlet.
A trucky singlet. Mm. Where's singlet gone? He goes nuts because he knows that he's blown his cover. He knows he's in trouble. So we all get bustled quickly into the van, and then there's extreme speed getting away from that spot. But only 5 kilometres down the road, we come across a police car heading in our direction that actually has Robin in the back seat directing the police to where we were. God. And then there's a high-speed chase, which is probably the most scariest part of the whole event. Literally, police end up shooting at us. Eastwood shoots at the police. Wow. I could not believe that he was shooting at the police out his window.
I can't believe they were shooting back. There's children in the car and you're in the car.
The police are aiming at the tyres, trying to shoot out the tyres so to stop the vehicle. They set up two roadblocks. They're stationary and they aim carefully. The fact that they missed wasn't very good, but bullets did go in funny places. But thankfully, somehow or other, we were protected and no one ended up with a bullet through them other than Eastwood, who got shot through the leg. Ultimately, we're all saved and no one's hurt except Eastwood, who ends up getting shot in the leg. So we were standing on the South Gippsland Highway halfway between Sale and Yarram at 7:30 on the Tuesday morning after we'd been kidnapped at 10:30 on the Monday morning.
And so I was thinking as well, when you're going through this absolute hell, what's happening in Warreen? Where are the kids? Where is Rob?
The number of people that turned up to search for us, because they actually thought initially that we had just gone for a walk, because Eastwood wrote on the door, gone on a nature study tour.
Very trip. Clever.
Be back in 1 hour.
He's a bloody clever. That's very clever.
He'd obviously been stewing in jail over this, hadn't he? And
it was well planned.
So they thought you'd taken the kids on a bushwalk and got lost.
Yes. Eventually they came into the school at 4:20 thinking, Rob, why haven't you let the kids out? And there's no one there, totally void of, it's just bare. They notice the note on the door. They notice the clock stopped at, I haven't told you that, have I? The one thing that I was able to do was stop the clock. It was an electric clock. Clock was stopped at around about 10 past 11. Because that was the time that he took us. I was able to pull the plug out from the wall to stop the clock. I wasn't able to write a note, wasn't able to make a phone call, I wasn't able to make any signals, but I did stop the clock. So they saw the clock, they saw my watch, my wallet and my keys on the teacher's table. Car was still there. Things did not look right.
What a nifty idea. Yeah,
that's some quick thinking.
The clock. Good on you, young man.
Yeah.
Wow, young Rob.
Thanks, girls.
Yeah. Eh? Okay, and you've left your watch and everything there. So something weird's gone on. It says they've gone on a bushwalk, but I don't know. There's something funny.
So they search. They can ring around. Amazed by the fact phone's not working in the school. One of the mums makes a phone call to the school, which the other mums that are at the school answer, but they can't hear each other because the earpiece is not working. So they're confused that this phone's not working. Eventually they decide at 4:30 that they've got to make a phone call to the police, so they go to the nearest farmhouse and make the phone call. Graham Washfold from Leongatha Police, when he entered the schoolroom, he very quickly ascertained that it was a crime scene, that the children had been taken, not by me, but by an intruder, partly because of the fact that my watch was there and my wallet and my keys and this weird note written on a piece of dodgy cardboard with capital letters that primary teachers would not write in with a felt-tip pen without a signature, not having let any parents know what was going on.
Such a weird one. I expect they probably thought you were dead. I would have. I would have thought if someone had taken children, they would not have kept you around. they would have wanted children for other things and would have disposed of you.
So that was certainly my fear, that I was going to be shot or got rid of, that the children would have been at his disposal without an adult.
You've taken us to the moment where you're standing by the side of the highway. So the siege, the hostage situation itself is over. You're safe. What happens next? The children are returned to their families, I guess. You're all driven back home.
Yeah, so we're driven to Sale Police Station and we spend the rest of the day, that day, Tuesday. We don't finish at Sale Police Station until about 3:30. Lots of press, lots of phone calls, lots of photos, lots of interviews. Got back to the school Tuesday evening, 5 p.m. My district inspector, the DI, Mr. Bull, said, "Rob, have the rest of the week off." So I got the Wednesday, Thursday, Friday off. I was back at school on the Monday. But on the Monday, I knew two of the children had left, weren't going to come back to the school, two of the oldest kids, they were going to go into Lee and Gather, that I would have seven children for the rest of the year. But then that morning, on the Monday morning, two more children didn't turn up. But they did turn up later after the press had arrived, which was really awkward. The parents and these two children wanted to tell me that they weren't going to come back to the school and there was nowhere private to speak. I tried to get around the corner of the school, but the press followed and took photos of this awkward meeting with the parents and these two children.
Just the understanding of trauma and that back then, it's like, I mean, I imagine, I guess also the parents' understanding of how to deal with what their children had gone through would have been very different to what it is now. And
take the rest of the week, Rob.
Yeah, that's
don't
it.
Don't hurry back.
A few days off.
Yeah, you've had a rough trot.
Wow.
See you Monday. So what's your understanding? What do you know of everybody else in the time since? The children, Robin Smith, the two women. What do you know about everybody else's recovery?
It's
and
a
lives?
funny scenario, isn't it?
Yeah.
As a 20-year-old, I didn't know what to do really.
But you kept teaching, right?
I did. The four children that left the school, I had no more contact with from then on for nearly 40 years. I continued teaching for the rest of the year at the school with five children. Those families, only three families for those five children, those three families were very supportive. I had good connections with them and I loved teaching that year with those five children. But I thought it was best for the children and for me that I finish at the end of that year. I went into the Latrobe Valley to get some colleagues to work with and I knew I needed to upskill with some good teaching models, which is what happened in Maui. But after that year, so I didn't follow up those families at all really, and time went by. One of the families I did meet when they relocated closer to the north where I had gone to live, but essentially we didn't have much contact until one of the students decided to come and visit me.
Oh, getting emotional. Yeah.
One of the students came to visit me in around about 2005, I think, and wanted to
30 years roughly.
35 years, wanted to thank me.
Oh, yeah.
Wanted to thank me for my role, that I'd done a good job. And
it's okay.
That unlocked the gate, as I describe in the book. A lot of pent-up emotion and I sort of realised after that I've got to write that book that I knew I'd always wanted to write.
Yeah. I feel like that's, you know, we know now that that's what happens when we don't, you know, offer victims the support that they need at the time, isn't it? It doesn't go away. It doesn't go anywhere. No. Time doesn't heal anything by itself. People need support to deal with trauma. Otherwise,
that's right. There was no proper counselling process.
Yeah.
Mind you, I'm now a trained counsellor.
Oh, well, that does not surprise
yeah,
me.
I think you've got some good skills to bring to it.
Absolutely, you do. I mean, you've got the leadership and you've got the caring nature, obviously. So that doesn't surprise me at all.
No. So, yeah, the book was an expression of my health. It's a celebration of my health. There's still a lot of emotion around the whole thing, as you can hear in my voice. But I write on the back of the book, the author celebrates the healing that is possible from such pain and torment, giving the reader renewed hope in a troubled world. That was my number one motivation, really, to write the book, to give hope to victims, to crime victims, but not just crime victims, people everywhere who experience hurt, pain, trauma of all sorts. I like to think that I've been healed from the trauma, and I think I have. And I talk about that quite a bit in the book, at the latter part of the book. And that's what's motivated my kidnap teacher talks, and particularly for secondary schools, wanting to share this story with students and share the health that I now enjoy and some of the principles that I followed which helped me get through that pain.
Yeah, I was just seeing on the back there you've got kidnappedteachertalks.com, Kidnapped Teacher Talks on Facebook, so people can book you to come and talk at their events and also at schools. That's fantastic.
Yeah, and it's becoming quite popular and it's taking off. This is a new thing. It's only a bit over 12 months old now. So I continued teaching up until February last year.
Amazing. I mean, that's what I mean. You've obviously got the resilience, you know, just built into your personality. So then for you to give yourself the gift of the counselling and, you know, that extra staff is what's pulled it all together for you, you know. You've got all that innate staff, but you weren't given the support at the time that we now know you needed. Yeah. But people just didn't know that then, did they?
I had terrific friends.
Yeah.
Wonderful family.
But people, I think, in those days thought, don't talk about it. Don't bring it up. Yeah. Don't remind
him. Just forget about it.
Yeah, just forget about it. Move on.
Get back on the horse.
Yes.
How did you self-manage? What were you doing?
I'd had a strong foundation, I suppose, which is one of the key things that helped me get along. Gratitude was really, really important. I had a lot to be thankful for. I focused on the positive. I focused on Robin Smith. I focused on the good things about the kidnapping, that everyone was safe. I remember choosing to say, okay, no, I'm going to be thankful for this.
God, you're so far ahead of your time.
Yeah, this is what Oprah became famous for.
You are so far ahead of your time.
The police were outstanding. The way in which the events unfolded, I really felt like someone was looking after us. The series of events were just uncanny. Robin Smith's, the timing of things was just impeccable. The saga of events, the way in which it unfolded. So I had a lot to be thankful for. And I still had my job. And one of the biggest things I was thankful for was that I didn't do anything stupid, which I very nearly did a couple of things stupid, like grabbing the gun that I didn't do. Robin often thinks about the same thing. He very nearly grabbed the gun at one stage too, and he's thankful that he didn't do that.
So you're still in touch with him?
So that student that came and visited 35 years after the event got me writing. And then as I started writing, I realised I needed to reconnect with all the players. And so we came up with the idea of a 40-year reunion. So it just happened to be that I'd started writing around about that time. 39 years, actually, I'd started writing. So I had 12 months of writing before the 40-year reunion. I didn't know I was going to write a book. I just knew I needed to get it all down. One of the students, Danny Forrester, who's a bit of a legend. He's a truck driver too. I love truck drivers.
We have a lot of truck drivers who listen to us, interestingly.
On the long drives, yeah.
Danny decided, okay, I'll organise this for you, Rob. That's not exactly how it happened, but he did it anyway. He organised a reunion, which is not the sort of reunion I would have organised. It would have been small and controlled. But
teacher-like.
Danny sort of let it out, and everybody got involved, lots of police, lots of locals, and he sought out Robin Smith, and Robin came to that event.
Oh, wow.
Wonderful.
What was that like?
How's he going?
You can imagine that first meet from all of the students that were there. Six of the nine students were able to attend.
Oh, wow.
And there wasn't a dry eye in the house, I don't think, when we came across Robin and his wife and three of his children. There was very fond embraces and lots of tears and heartfelt emotion.
How's he going? Is he good?
Robin Smith continues to be a very unassuming, absolute legend of a man.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful, wonderful. Mm. I love him now.
Yeah, you'll love him when you meet him too one day.
Yeah.
We want to.
Yeah, I really do want to.
We've actually applied for a bravery award for Robin.
Now, from the hero of the piece to one of the heroes, because I think you're also one of the heroes of the piece, to the villain of the piece, we should let listeners know that on Monday, November 7th, 1977, 38 weeks after the crime, the kidnapper, Eastwood, Edwin Eastwood, pled guilty in the Supreme Court to 16 counts of kidnapping, 3 of theft of vehicles, 3 of using a firearm to avoid arrest, 1 of escape and 1 of burglary and 1 of theft. He was sentenced to 21 years with a minimum of 18 and was released from jail in 1993. I can't find anything further online about him, so who knows? Keeping quiet, hopefully.
What are your feelings about Eastwood now?
This is a big topic. The word forgiveness is the one that I talk about in the book. I decided to forgive Eastwood. That wasn't an easy thing to do. I guess for me it was a prayer or a statement or I choose to forgive. It wasn't saying that what he did was okay, because what he did was despicable. It had far-reaching consequences. But in forgiving, I let go of the inclination to get even. I was just letting go of the right, if you like. I don't know whether you've got a right or not to feel as if you want to get even. But that meant that I didn't stay bitter, angry, resentful, and that I was able to get over the trauma of that event much more easily. The healing process was able to take place because I'd let go of that desire. I share this with secondary students and the people I talk to, that if I hadn't forgiven, the chain that had been wrapped around my wrist, it'd be like that chain was still attached to him, and that I'd be dragging him around with me for the rest of my life. And I didn't want that. And that doesn't hurt him, it only hurts me. So to be released from him was very releasing and healthy and freeing.
Thank you. This has been just
incredible.
Oh, just such an inspiring, wonderful conversation for so many reasons. I mean, I knew it was an incredible story, but I didn't expect for you to be such an inspiring person to talk to. Thank you. And
thank you very much.
Thanks, yes. Michelle. Thanks,
and
Emily.
I didn't know kidnapped teacher talks existed and would be such a great thing that I'd be recommending to so many people.
Yeah. Great.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Rob.
He's an inspiring guy, isn't he? Rob Hunter, former teacher and now public speaker, who can be contacted and booked at kidnappedteachertalks.com. And his book, Day 9 at Warreen, can be pre-ordered at Wilkinson Publishing. We have 2 copies to give away to patrons at our Patreon page. That's patreon.com/austtruecrimepod. That's AUST, True Crime Pod. Thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. We'll be back next week with another episode.